The late Gil Quall hunted, fished, and gathered wild foods in and around the Chippewa National Forest. And for over 25 years, Gil did programs about wild foods on KAXE. Gil learned a lot about wild foods from his Ojibwe neighbors, and this evening we have an essay that he recorded about the food of the Anishinaabe.
They arrived here from the east a century before the first white settlers, carrying with them an unwritten catalog of natural materials and a way of life that was interesting and unusual. They were pioneers moving into a vacuum left by the departing Sioux and occupying a time span of about 150 years. Because the season, location, and yearly response of living things is predictable, the Ojibwe fell into a pattern of activity that coincided with nature and was useful to them. It was their niche in this new country, and it served them well. It provided food, health, religion, and a sense of purpose. The Indian who lived here was most likely a member of a small group of three or four households who followed a yearly circuit of some 25 miles. Along its perimeter, they found most of the ingredients necessary for their lifestyle. As practical ecologists, they managed to be at the right place at the right time. As masters of improvisation, they gathered and processed what is necessary for their subsistence. At least twice a year, the small groups coalesced into larger encampments for the purpose of making maple sugar or the gathering of manomen, which we know as wild rice. These were times of increased social interaction and great enjoyment. The Ojibwe brewed hot teas from twigs, leaves, and barks of such plants as creeping snowberry, Labrador tea, raspberry, wintergreen, cherry, and spruce. On hot days, they drank cool water and flavored it with maple sugar. Their main staple was wild rice, and it was cooked in different ways and seasoned with various things such as mint, woodbine, sugar, or meat. Nutritious and reliable, it was their principal carbohydrate. Therefore, it was necessary to accumulate up to 200 pounds per person per year. Scarcely less important was maple sugar, put into mokoks, or birch bark containers, and stored in small wigwams or earth pits. It was available to sweeten even the bitterest of winter days. Fish was by far the most common animal protein, but moose, rabbit, bear, deer, duck, and grouse were frequent meals, especially after the proliferation of rifles. Almost all animals were suitable for their pot. In fact, the carcasses of pelted fur bears were used as food. For example, beaver tail was an absolute favorite among them. Bearberry and wild ginger were seasoners, and the meat was often introduced into rice dishes, soups, and stews. The excess was preserved for lean times by sun or by fire drying, except, of course, in the winter when deep freeze temperatures made easier means of preserving it. Vegetables included the tubers of Jerusalem artichoke, arrowhead, and bugleweed, while milkweed flowers served as an appetizer and aster leaves garnished their fish. Hog peanuts, hazelnuts, and acorns were snack foods, while jerky and dried berries sustained them on hikes and hunts. Sometimes these two were compounded with an animal tallow, such as bear fat, to make pemmican, an especially nutritious and high-calorie food. Berries added flavor and color to their meals and their lives. Fresh or dried, they were an essential part of their diet. In addition to blueberries, raspberries, and strawberries, they gathered others such as currants, grapes, high bush cranberries, bunchberries, and juneberries. When the crop was good, it was not simply a gathering, but a campout that might last for days while bushels of fruit were accumulated. But gatherings of this sort are all in the past, and because of our lifestyle, we can only tinge our lives with the concept of self-sufficiency. If we feel a little smug over a bucket of berries or a limit of walleyes, we need to only emphasize for a moment with the people of that century and realize that we are, after all, rank amateurs.